Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting individual, Florencia Lujani. She's a strategy director based in London who specializes in brand and creative strategy for brands. She started her career over 10 years ago at TBWA Buenos Aires, where she learned about disruption planning, working with McDonald's, developing regional strategies for Latin America, and moved to the UK, where she joined J. Walter Thompson. She's worked at traditional creative agencies, at digital shops like We Are Social, and as cultural strategist at Ketchum PR before joining Media Bounty, one of the leading ethical creative agencies in the UK. She works with brands in the climate sector, developing strategies that help shift the world to a sustainable economy. She's also recently completed a master's in cultural studies from Birkbeck, obviously University of London, where she studied the intersection of culture, the economy, advertising, the climate crisis, and consumer culture. She's also published her Substack newsletter, Cultural Patterns, where she writes about cultural phenomena, new forms of creativity, the climate crisis, emerging consumer behavior, and their impact on brand strategy. She's written for Walk, Drum, Contagious, The Guardian, Marketing Week, and her thinking has been published in the UK, Spain, Germany, the US, and Latin America. Fantastic. So, Florencia, hi, and how are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me today, Sean. Very, very excited to be chatting with you. All things brands, strategy, creativity, and probably a little bit of the climate crisis as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that there's a ton that we want to talk about because I know you have such a broad range of interests and such a lot of also specialist knowledge in them. So, I mean, obviously the big thing, and in terms of when this podcast is being recorded, we're right on the eve of COP26. I know you've been, obviously you've been involved in all things ecological, environmental for many, many years from a sort of strategy, thinking, insights perspective, etc. But okay, so we might as well just go straight in on the big one. So COP26.
Yes, we're in the eve of COP26 kicking off in Glasgow in the UK. And it's just going to be really interesting to see how that plays up and how the UK takes either a leadership role in it or a little bit of a different role. We'll see what happens there. But yes, I've been thinking a lot about the climate crisis and how this is going to be a really interesting period to really connect with people about the climate crisis and what it means for us. So yes, I recently written an article for my newsletter, Cultural Patterns, about the different challenges of really communicating climate change, because it's one of those issues that is usually communicated with a lot of scientific talk, which is really hard to digest, to really understand and to translate into actions. And many of that scientific talk, really what makes people do is just they just tune out. And for some other people, the facts-driven approach is really a bit of a wake-up call. So there are many different challenges to really communicating the climate crisis, because we really can't be too scientific or be too abstract. which is very easy to deal with climate because we really need to engage people. And at the same time, we can't be too cheerful or optimistic or hopeful because there is a lot that needs to change in this tricky situation. So finding the right balance is tricky, to say the least. And what I found from the work that I've been doing at Media Bounty and the different projects with the climate sector that I've been involved in is that basically there are four different reasons why people don't engage with the climate crisis. I call them the four Ds, and they usually overlap. It's not that they are in a scale or anything, but they are usually present at the same time. And we switch from one to the other, and it's basically there are very, very different reasons for why we just try to forget about the climate crisis. And it comes to, it's down to brands to really navigate those barriers. So the first D, the first reason why people don't engage with the climate crisis is distance. We sometimes consider climate change a distant issue. There's a lot of framing around, 2050 targets, net zero around 2050. And that really helps to kind of create that distance in time and space for us. So framings around, it's something that we should worry about in 2050, or climate change is happening somewhere else, or even distance at a socioeconomical level. So, for example, it's an issue for white privileged people. So distance can be experienced in many different ways, but these are feelings that are just amplified whenever we think about this being an issue that is really not for us and not for right now. So the second D that really explains why people don't engage with the climate crisis is a sense of denial. And thankfully, only 3% of people in the UK think that the climate isn't changing. So denial is not necessarily about not believing that climate change is real. Denial also shows in different ways, and perhaps is more of a priority from a communications perspective, which is a bit of a belief that no change is possible. So, for example, I can't do anything to mitigate climate change, or nothing will change, so why bother? And some other things that I think we will see after COP, which is aligned to, it's all useless talk. So why are we even, looking at this? And I think in that sense, denial takes away agency from us and the real impact that we can have when we ask for systemic change. So really denial of possibility and denial of solutions and better futures is also very present. Then the third D is delay, which, there are so many issues happening at the same time. I think we're in a bit of a, we've just been through a pandemic, which of course, it's not over, but it has left a little bit of, I would say, a little bit of collective trauma with all of us. And a lot of people just don't see the value of tackling climate change right now when we have so many issues to deal with that just came from the pandemic and just in general of the world and the different systemic inequalities that we're dealing with. So delaying climate action really deflects responsibility. So it's really great to keep the status quo in place. It's really great for, powerful countries that are given kind of like the green light to just delay more action towards climate change, climate action. So for example, there are other more urgent priorities, so we shouldn't be spending so much money or time on climate change. Other kind of messages are around like the next generation should solve it, or I'm not going to do much until governments and companies really sort it out. So in this sense, delay, we want to delay climate action because we think it's a sacrifice, and that just creates a lot of fear. A fear that action towards climate change will worsen our quality of life or leave us poorer. And it's just useful to postpone it, climate action into some hypothetical future, because it just allows for things to remain the same, which a lot of people want and are very interested in seeing happen. So these delay narratives, really what they do is they just inoculate us against this very real thing that has intruded into our life, into our, ecological, social space. So that's very helpful from a delay perspective. And finally, I think there's a lot of people will feel a bit, that they might feel this is the doom feeling and just reaction towards the climate crisis. Because I think for a long time, and we've seen it in the UK with some movements and some specific organizations that really spreading the message of something being an emergency, as the climate being an emergency, the climate crisis, that we have no time left to act. It's now or never. Or I don't know if you've seen, but there have been the doom clock, which showcases the time left to act, which I think right now is standing at 8 years. So all of that is just, even though the intent is really to make it a priority, the apocalyptic narrative of this catastrophe doesn't really help, because fear is doesn't inspire us. Fear triggers that kind of fight or flight response. It's basically a very biological thing. So if we want to inspire people, fear is not going to take us there. So there's also really, it's not that the sun will not arise tomorrow if we don't fix climate change. Our lives will go on. So the narrative of, no time left to act is really exaggerated, because we know it's not true. So because it's not true, it's also easy to ignore and dismiss, which doesn't mean that our quality of life won't be much worse in the future if we don't do anything about it. The exaggeration doesn't really compel people as well. So the messages of doom are just a little bit tone deaf as well in a context in which people have had to worry about surviving day to day during a pandemic. In that sense, again, they don't inspire or don't engage people. They just create, they make it easier for people to ignore it. So yes, basically the challenges are varied and are there is a tone balance that climate communications really need to strike to make sure that we are making this engaging, but at the same time creating that rally of action that we need from every part of society. Every climate communications brief has its own challenge to tackle.
Mm. How fascinating. I know I think you mentioned that you put that latest piece out for the IPG via both yourself and Harriet Kingerby. Absolutely superb stuff. I thought it was really fascinating what you're just describing there in terms of the four Ds, because it's such a clear and coherent way of doing it. Certainly from a personal perspective, I think certainly, I mean, obviously on this podcast, I've had some great people. So, you know, back when we started it, obviously the likes of sort of Will Skeeping, Extinction Rebellion, you know, a year or so ago, and then Rob Hopkins and Charlie Waterhouse, obviously massively linked into it, and then other side of the world, Lucy Sturmer, the great Andy Middleton and Dan Burgess, etc. And it's been fascinating how this issue, as you just put it, about getting the tone right of inverted commas climate communication is so important, because I think there's a lot of talk around some of the sort of conversations in the media in the middle-ish of last year seem to get drowned out for perhaps understandable reasons, when we were really in the middle of or the early stages of all things sort of COVID-19 related, and it seemed to be that a lot of this was put on the back burner, and then just the tone seemed to sort of change in terms of getting the public, if you say the mainstream public, on side. There seemed to be quite a lot of activity taking place that seemed to alienate rather than engage and motivate and all the rest of it. It was fascinating. How about, so in some of the things you've also written recently, I think, super interesting. So it'd be great to go through some of those. So let's say just taking three in particular. So one of the pieces you wrote about titled Building Businesses for Permanence, Not Performance, where you talked about, and I'm quoting yourself back to you here, you know, the economic system prioritizes growth, so it's a standard that structures our social life with regards to culture, media, and so much more. Imagine what it could look like if let's say, in this sense, in a business context, if clients had different priorities. So perhaps just talk us through your thinking there from the point of view of building businesses for permanence, not performance.
Sure. I've been very interested in the culture of our economic system, basically, and how that basically structures everything that we do in our social life. And yes, our relationships, our personal goals, our language, our creativity, everything is defined by our economic system, because I'm quoting Manuel Castells here, but the economy is culture in the way that we do everything based on the logics of the market. So I think it came to a point last year as I was working more and more with the climate sector, and I was continuing doing my work with brands, that I just started to think about what were the consequences of really operating within that culture of permanent, eternal growth that we have internalized as the only possible thing. And for example, I remember Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s saying, you know, there is no alternative for our economic system. And I think a lot of that we have really internalized and come to think as, you know, a totem of our society. So there is no alternative for in the way that we do business. And I just didn't want to kind of accept that in that sense. And I just started reading about other perspectives, and I discovered the field of environmental economists and the way that they talk about the economy is not as something that is separated from nature, as in nature is over there with the natural world and the biosphere and ecology, and the economy is, you know, market forces and supply and demand or other kind of market terminologies. But environmental economists see the economy as a subset of nature, because we really can't have an economy if we don't preserve our natural environment. And to me, that was a revelation because, first of all, we as strategists need to understand the context in which we operate. And we're not just building, you know, fun, relatable, engaging brands that people, you know, consume every day. We're also contributing to the global market, and we are a very important part of the global economy. So to me, bringing that perspective into the work that I do was very important. And that's when one of the main things that the environmental economists say is that the economic activity is reaching planetary limits. So if you can just edit that, that'll be great. We'll do. So what the planetary limits mean is that we are just, you know, extracting and destroying natural resources in a much at a much faster rate than we are able to replenish them. Everything that we take from the natural world that we use to create batteries for electric cars, or you know, regular cars, or our computers, our phones, the natural resources that we use to build our homes, or create the clothes that we wear. Everything we take from nature, and we are taking and destroying at a much faster rate than we are replenishing them. So I think in that sense, what are we working towards has to be from a business level, has to be aligned with the planetary reality. And in that sense, growth was at the center of that. Because what we do is just basically try to grow the global economy at a 3% rate yearly. So increasing and, you know, this continuous and nonstop growth at 3% requires just a degree of violence on our earth that would just result in an ecological system breakdown within the next 100 years, which I think is really, it's really not too far away. It's very, very soon. And so if the economy needs to grow at a 3%, this means doubling the size of the economy every 23 years. So the economy of the 2000s must be 20 times larger in the year 2100, and then 370 times larger in the year 2200. So this is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the planet is not being replenished. We are taking at a rate, at a level that maybe we could afford to do it 70 years ago, when we had a different ecological reality, but it's not aligned with what the planet can give us anymore. So we are growing businesses at the expense of destroying the well-being of people and the planet. So basically what I tried to do with that article that I wrote is to say that the way that we do businesses need to be aligned with the social and ecological impact of the next 100 years. So we can't really keep on designing businesses for the performance of the 3% every year, but we need to make sure that in 100 years there's still going to be a planet, an economy, thriving humans, and a thriving society. And in that sense, there are so many questions that come out of that, because if we don't focus on growth, what do we do? And I think it just opens up so many uncomfortable questions that it is one of those topics that I just been thinking a lot about this year and have really defined the work that I've been doing this year. And it's a big question because we need to make sure that what we do serves people on the planet. And at this point in time, it's just not aligned with our planetary realities. So definitely one of those questions that I'm it's a bit uncomfortable to sit with at some points.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was fascinating to me talking there about sort of the perspectives taken by a whole raft of environmental economists. And I know you mentioned obviously that the mighty Kate Raworth, apart from anything else, author of the fantastic Donut Economics, where she talks about economics being the mother tongue of public policy, the language of public life and the mindset that shapes society. I thought it was fascinating. Last year we saw, even from the likes of Klaus Schwab, obviously heads up the World Economic Forum, and Thierry Malleret, when they put out the really dynamic Great Reset, which came out very, very quickly after certainly COVID kicked off. It seemed to me to be, you know, the first big book that really, as they put it there in terms of the great unraveling, you know, COVID had torn up the script by which we agreed on how to sort of, you know, govern countries and companies, live with others and take part in the global economy. And there was, as they really pointed out, we're at a pivotal historical moment, and it really, really had a big focus there naturally on the climate crisis and ecological emergency. I thought really fascinating, again, one of the other pieces you wrote about unleashing creative possibilities, talking about, again, as you just did, we're moving from focusing solely on extracting from actual financial value, we also need to design businesses in a way that generates other benefits for society as a whole. There's also, I thought, a really interesting angle you took there, which no doubt links back into the research you did, certainly when you're doing your recent master's, that issue about, on a really sort of global societal level, issues with regards to the north-south consumption divide. Perhaps just talk a bit about that, about issues of, if you say, the morality of consumption linking into privilege and history.
Yes, of course. There is a lot to unpack and talk about when thinking about the division between the global north and the global south. Of course, the global north enjoys a level of consumption that has been possible because of the thriving economy that countries in the global north have achieved and developed through the colonization and extraction of natural resources from the global south. So the wealth in the global north is mostly thanks to the global south. And that on its own is very... There are so many interesting books and articles wrote about those dynamics because they really do affect everything. And then it's going to affect the next 100 years even more. So the global south is the carbon emissions and levels of consumption in the global south are just very, very small compared to the global north. I think the numbers off the top of my head are in the global north, carbon emissions per person attached to consumption are between 15 and 25 tons of carbon a year. And in the global south, they are between 5 and 10. That is information from the C40 cities, which is an organization that looks at carbon emissions in different parts of the world. And it is difficult to talk about a reduction of carbon emissions as a blanket statement for the whole world, because the global south still needs to develop and get to a place of thriving economies and thriving societies in the same way that the global north was afforded it.
Yeah.
And of course,
also east-west.
Exactly. And so when we talk about global, you know, reducing global emissions, we are also talking about rich countries doing a lot more of that effort, because they are the ones that pollute the most as well. So the ones that the countries that pollute the most are the ones that also need to reduce the most. And it is the way that things work, that the global south, which is the, you know, which emits less carbon, is the one that also experiences the worst impacts of climate change. So this is a dynamic that is very interesting from a social and cultural perspective, but also it frames the way in which climate change needs to be discussed and talked about depending on where we are in the world, because it's not the same to create a campaign that aims to reduce emissions from richer countries than what it is to increase awareness of climate change in the global south. So a lot of kind of elements that need to be taken into consideration to make sure that there isn't a blanket approach, because social, cultural, and economic elements need to be taken into consideration there. So,
yeah.
In that sense, at the same time, when creating communications around this topic, you need that perspective, because without the perspective of the global north and the global south, you can end up with communications that just misses the mark.
And linking to that, again, I think it's really interesting, the point you made earlier on about, again, under your four Ds, with regards to, I think, exactly that issue. And it links as much, I think, as you're saying, to the global north, global south, on a physically global level, as much as it does sort of culturally within cultures. So from the point of view of the likes of the dreadful orange man, Trump, you know, as part of the 3% that you mentioned earlier on, who had obviously a very large following as well, many of whom clearly were not on board with this at all. He talks about people who found it easy to dismiss, who were perhaps far more interested on that level of survival day to day, in terms of a significant part of that sort of a voter base that viewed this as being a very privileged discussion, that the sort it just didn't link into their day to day reality, which is, I've got to put food on the table. I'm not actually that concerned about what's going to happen in 20 years' time, let alone 50 years. It's all about actually tomorrow and next week.
Yeah, of course. And I think there are different elements there at play as well, because the Global South, there are other priorities, because a lot of the countries are still trying to find their feet and still trying to develop thriving economies. But I also think that it helps the biggest polluters and the bigger emitters shield themselves from the responsibility that they have. And in that sense, that is also why I really hope that COP26 is an opportunity for the UK to take a leadership role, because we are one of the biggest carbon emitters of the world alongside the rest of the G7. But those are the countries that need to take the biggest responsibility and take the strongest action, because they also can't afford it. And there's also lots of ideological battles within that.
Because
being able to afford it doesn't mean that you are going to fund it. Because I think one of the biggest battles that we will see at COP26, and what I think is the background of COP26, is the ideological battle between those who believe in the free market and the neoliberal way of, you know, a neoliberal economic system, and those who really are asking the government to step up and make sure that we have systemic change. So I think the main issues that we will see as well at COP26 will have that ideological background of, you know, the neoliberal free market economic system is working pretty well for me. Why would I change it while at the same time being asked to change it because these countries have the money to afford it? So it's going to be interesting to see it played out, because what is being asked is not necessarily what they want to do or what they support from an ideological perspective. I think in that sense, this is also a conservative government, which means that in the US it's pretty easy to say that that climate action is a leftist issue, and at least in the UK we can showcase that it should be across the political spectrum, but it will be difficult to see how these things played out, because I'm not too sure that the current government will want to go against the neoliberal economic system that has been so beneficial and that has constituted the backbone of the economy. So in that sense, COP26 is about the climate crisis as much as it's about the ideological differences between countries and what we should do to protect the world and to have a thriving future.
Mm. I was going to say, I thought it's fascinating. There's a superb supplement went out recently in The Guardian looking at those who've been arrested trying to save the planet, and they had a whole array of activists and those involved, including obviously the mighty Gail Bradbrook, who can't put a foot wrong, I think. What a fantastic individual she is. Who obviously had started off things like Citizens Online, massively involved in animal rights, and then transitioned Stroud and all the rest of it before setting up Exile with Roger Hallam. Also in there's a great piece, or great interview with, again, the equally mighty Paul Simonon, obviously, who started out back in the day as the bass player with The Clash before becoming an epic artist in his own right. And he wrote a very interesting piece there about, or was interviewed a very interesting piece about being arrested while involved on some activism with Greenpeace, and then being jailed and sent to Greenland and in jail, and then nearly getting attacked in the jail by people who initially absolutely viewed perhaps him and his fellow activists from Greenpeace who are involved in some anti-oil rig activity from the point of view of, as you were just saying, having a very, very sort of leftist, elitist perspective, until he actually just talks about the fact that, yes, this is something that impacts not just obviously them, but their children, and then certainly grandchildren, if the planet is still in one piece when they're about. Let's move on in terms of another piece that you wrote recently with regards to, as you put it, we're not a materialistic society. I thought it was a really interesting angle, this. So, again, quoting you back to you. So advertising is fundamentally a meaning-making practice. We transform material objects into cultural signals to differentiate, create a common understanding, and put a premium on price. As a famous cultural critic, Raymond Williams, said, our problem isn't that we're too materialistic, it's that we're not materialistic enough. We devalue the material world by the excessive acquisition and discarding of products. Now, you and in many ways so do I, work in a industry which is absolutely charged with being all about encouraging people in the excessive acquisition and discarding of products. So I just wondered, in terms of your sort of day-to-day life in agency world, how this really lands with a broad selection of clients who may well have a perspective that they've got to hit their quarterly targets, and quite frankly, they can put the planet to one side while they encourage people to buy more and more stuff. Where does that stand with you and one's day-to-day life?
Yes, it's difficult to have those kind of conversations because it goes back to the question of what do we do if we don't prioritize growth?
I
think what I like to think is that today we're in a context in which there are two types of businesses. And one type of business is driven by a last century question, by this question of how much financial value can we extract from this business and from this opportunity? So a model that has been really successful for the past 100 years, right? When just extracting value from human and natural resources through very unsustainable practices just was able to deliver that 3% sustained growth that I was talking about earlier. In this context, we also have to remember that we are approaching planetary limits. So there is an opportunity to really change businesses and really deliver on bigger value and see bigger returns. And I think this century's question for business should be how many benefits for society and planet can we generate with our business? So companies that are driven by the financial value question are very extractive. So they extract value from humans and natural resources, while the other question that is around benefits for society and planet that can be generated with a business are regenerative. So they they create value for customers while also delivering profit and building a sustainable economy. So regenerative businesses really create, you know, abundance, possibility, but they are also going to be at the forefront of huge, you know, economic value generation. So they're going to be really important business opportunities of being regenerative as a business. So I think I think that is the main question. Are you an extractive business or are you a regenerative business? Are you driven by the unsustainable practices that were able to deliver sustained growth for the past 100 years, even though we are reaching planetary limits? Or are you at the forefront of being a regenerative business that can have an impact on the planet and society?
Yeah, fantastic. I thought it was really interesting also, I mean, recently, about 6 months ago now, obviously, the mighty John Elkington, the godfather of sustainability, put out that fantastic book, Green Swans, with regards to, as you're just saying, the coming boom in regenerative capitalism. And the book naturally was incredibly well received, and John's a fantastic guy. And I thought it was really interesting, again, in your piece, you're talking there about just one example of, okay, so what do we do then if in a business context you've got clients saying, okay, I get it. Perhaps you could lay out some practical steps that that businesses, organizations, brands can actually take.
Yeah, sure. I think it's always useful to think about some actionable steps, even more so when in the next 2 weeks with COP, we're going to be swimming in an ocean of really big ecological and economic terms that we want to take and be able to translate into the business realm. So back to what I was saying about being extractive or regenerative businesses, I think that the first thing that you can do is just do nothing, right? Continue being extractive. The business of business is business. That is the world. Everything that we're doing is legal. So we're just going to carry on until price or regulation forces us to change. That is the first response. Of course, you know, the oldest one, one could say has passed its expiry date, but it's still very present. The next thing that you can do is really do what pays. So, you know, cut your carbon emissions if it costs, you know, get a green certification if you think that that will boost sales. do something that you can see the financial benefit of. So, for example, something that you would think will have appeal from a consumer perspective. So, smaller steps, far too incremental for the scale of change that is needed, but at least is doing something.
Yeah.
Then the next thing that you can do is do your fair share. So that means matching your country's target emissions. So cutting greenhouse gas emissions, cutting carbon. Yeah. And in that way, you can just get a little bit more serious now, right? So you think that that is the least that you can do. Your fair share really is going to, you know, it might start adding up in that sense. Then the next thing that you can do, and now this is getting a little bit more interesting, is being an emission zero company. So really aim for net zero carbon emissions, zero deforestation in supply chains, or any other unsustainable practice, just getting rid of it. So that is more transformative. That is actually starting to doing good and being scientifically led and committed to being a net zero carbon emission company.
Yeah.
And the best thing that you can do is get to that point where you are a generative company. So, the way that you do your business not only, sequesters carbon, but also cleans the air, pays living wages, and even, builds a community or adds to your local community. And then that, of course, is incredibly powerful. And that is the type of company that really, creates benefits, not only for customers in the company, but also for the people working for the company and the communities around the company and the environment overall. So that is the type of companies that Kate Raworth and so many other environmental economists are really pushing for to see more of, because that impact is huge. You know, I was mentioning before how we are reaching those planetary limits. So it's not only great to do, net zero, it's even better to replenish the natural resources that we use and build communities and add to society in general, which to me is very important that, and I don't know if you noticed, but I never use the word purpose. I don't, because this is about ecological and planetary limits. This is about a climate crisis that is coming and is here, and it will impact every part of what we do. And I believe, today, you and I, we are climate strategists. We need to understand how the climate is going to disrupt every part of the business, not only from a communications and advertising perspective, but all the way through. And I think if you don't have a climate plan, then you don't have a business plan.
Mm.
So in that sense, action needs to be taken from a business perspective to become regenerative, while at the same time being supported by a critical climate action from government. Mm. And support of climate action from people.
Mm.
And consumers. So that is the whole package for me.
Yeah. And that, just on that completely business cold-hearted inner focused sort of a perspective I thought was really interesting. I mean, I remember quoting my last book, Mark Carney, as he was then the Governor of the Bank of England, as I said, who's not someone normally given to extreme statements. So, you know, the Governor of the Bank of England saying firms ignoring the climate crisis will go bankrupt. But there'll also be those that will do very well because they'll be part of the solution. So, you know, one of those. And as the FT pointed out at the time, they said, you know, everything's dying out. Half of all wild animals have been lost since 1970. The Amazon's burning, as is the Arctic, as was this summer, you know, half of southern Europe, as was obviously the western seaboard of America, as was half of Siberia.
For sure, and on top of that, there's also the human element to all of that, because if you know, the loss in the natural world is devastating, but at the same time, you know, when hurricanes and tsunamis really have an impact on Asia, a lot of companies are gonna be out of workforce and are gonna be impacted by problems not only in their production process, but also at every point. The reality is that the world right now can't really function without the people from the global south, and companies depend on the people there to grow and to make money and make their profits every year. So if climate change is going to impact where you have your factories and where you have the people doing, you know, doing your garments or creating your products, then there's not going to be a really easy way out. So everything is connected. It's very important that when we think about the climate crisis, we think about the natural impact and disaster, but also the human impact, in that sense of like all of the people that we depend on that do their bit on the global economic system as well.
Right, very well put, if I can say so. I mean, as we begin to reach the end of this talk, it's been so fascinating talking with you, Florencio. Thank you so much. I mean, just looking to reaching for one of the many books that surrounds me. So the Mighty This Is Not a Drill by the equally mighty Extinction Rebellion. So yeah, that thought that fascinating, you know, as they say, the Declaration of Rebellion, we hold the following to be true. This is our darkest hour. The science is clear. We're in the sixth mass extinction event and we'll face catastrophe if we don't act swiftly and robustly. And again, as again the mighty Gale Bradbrook put it then, you know, what is your place in these times? This is an international rebellion aligning all people struggling to protect life on Earth. This is sacred. So as we begin to finish off then, Florencio, just looking to the short-term future and the medium-term future, so what are you up to at the moment? What are you working on from the perspective of, obviously, I mean, right on top of us right now is COP26, but in terms of any initiatives that you may be involved in at the moment that you can talk about, anything you can put across?
For sure, yes. So as you mentioned, Harriet Kingaby and me, we just launched a report on climate misinformation and its impact on brand strategy just in time for COP26. So that is part of the IPA's climate charter. So you can go into the IPA website and download it under the brand safety section. It's all about understanding how climate misinformation spreads and what brands can do about that, how they can prepare and how they can react. We have tons of really interesting examples from Nike, Sainsbury's, ITV. So really good guide for people to have a look at if they are interested in understanding how misinformation impacts brands. I am also working on other climate projects. I'm working with an organization that's on a mission to accelerate the switch to electric vehicles. So I'm doing some some brand strategy for them. And we're going to be launching as well a creative campaign that I'm really excited about. I'm going to be featured on the Canvas 8 Expert Outlook for this year. So again, talking about brands and climate and cultural in general. So that should be, that's always a good read. So hopefully that would be an interesting one. And then some of my thinking on everything that we've been discussing today, economics, culture, brands, is going to be featured on the next walk guide. So walk's going to be launching a new guide very soon, and then you're going to be able to read a lot of this thinking there, as well as, of course, being available in my blog/newsletter. So yeah, very lots of things going on, and hopefully, you know, more and more companies really start to think about what they can do and should do around their climate efforts, way beyond communications, but real action as well. So hopefully more to come on that front.
Absolutely fantastic. And I guess final thing then, just so everyone is totally clear where they can track you down, go on then, where are you on all the usual platforms?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Twitter, that's Flor Lujani. I'm on LinkedIn as well, Florencia Lujani. You can find me there and connect with me. And then my newsletter is on Substack, is culturalpatterns.substack.com. And yeah, that's it's just been a real pleasure talking to you. So so thank you so much for inviting me over and for, you know, being so receptive to some of these ideas. And just, yeah, it was a great conversation.
Florencia Lujani, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.